Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever you may be listening. Mike Carpenter here with episode 3 of the Decadence Podcast. This is actually part 2 of a conversation me, Alan, and Mike had before Thanksgiving week hit and before we all dispersed and got into the holiday spirit with our friends and family, a much needed break. We got a big 2015 coming up, so this is actually a nice way to kind of stay on top of things as we close down 2014, reflect on what we've done, look forward to all the new original music that we're writing right now, and some big gigs we already have lined up for 2015, which we'll be announcing soon. That's called The Tease. Great news about our podcast. If you have an iPhone, you can find us on your podcast app. Just search Decadence. You can also find the links to these podcasts on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/decadence.band. Most importantly, if you have not listened to our album, Elegantly Wasted, it's available direct at decadence.bandcamp.com on iTunes, Google Play, Amazon, all that good stuff as well. And if you want to listen before you buy the whole thing, Spotify is the way to go. We aren't like Taylor Swift. We're cool with being on Spotify. We just want as many new ears to listen to our music as possible. So we're going to continue this conversation. It was about a 2.5 hour thing, so we cut it in half. And what me, Alan, and Mike Solomon talk about here include Ben Donaldson's awesome drumming skills, how I used to be a controlling asshole, and a lot on the art of the guitar solo. So really good stuff here for episode 3 of the Decadence Podcast. Enjoy.
His first bass player that he named was James Jamerson, the guy that did all the Motown bass playing.
We were actually just, it was Aretha Franklin Think.
Yeah.
And we thought that might have been James Jamerson.
But like, that's the thing about him is like, he was on everything. He was like the studio bassist who just played on everything from that era.
There was a Rolling Stone article about James Jamerson. I want to say he passed away maybe 4 or 5 years ago, something like that. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it wasn't an article in memoriam. It was just an article about him. But all the different records that he was on. And it's the sort of weird mix of bouncy yet smooth. Like, it's always holding that low end, but it's got a melodic touch to it that a lot of bass playing does not.
Yeah, and there were a bunch of... apparently, he would only play with one finger. Like, he would pluck the bass with only one finger. And there were all these bass lines written when he first came into the scene. And no one could play these bass lines. And he sat down there, and people are like, this guy's never going to be able to play it. And then just playing with one finger, he was able to just slay all of these bass lines. And yeah, he like that bounciness was what Jimmy had. But then the other two were the bass player from Queen. And
that's an interesting selection right there.
Yeah.
That's the last guy from Queen I think about is the bass player.
But like... That's probably just part of being a bassist, is you look for the people who are being ignored otherwise, just constantly ignored. And then the third was...
I feel like that's me saying that Cliff Williams from AC/DC is my favorite bass player. I respect what he does for the band, but at the same time, there's not a lot that he's doing that I would consider influential. But I like the bold pick from Jimmy. Jimmy Jenkins. Oh, wait, Jimmy Pittman.
And his third bassist was Steve Harris from Iron Maiden.
Well, there you go. That's right up your alley.
And like, he would do the same Gallup thing, but like, I think it was more the fact that he was staking a claim on songwriting. He was trying to take that from me. Because at the time, I was just this control freak asshole. And
am I a control freak asshole? Can we get that out of the way?
You used to be.
I did.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I'm sorry.
But, like, that was also, I don't know what bands you had been in before. Like, Ben and I have talked about this before, that there was one night where Ben came over and we hung out after a show at White Horse.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks at me, he's like, I'm not really having fun, man. Like, I'm not.
I remember that period where I could tell that he wasn't.
And
we actually talked about it, too, and I think it was a mix of probably, I mean, I might have had something to do with it, certainly. But then also the fact that the commute, because, you know, he's going to ISU now, that commute was starting to weigh on him.
Yeah.
And we hadn't quite hit our stride.
And I said I wasn't having much fun either. But then we started talking about it, and we decided that we were just going to wrestle control from you. that you would give us all of these notes while we were while we would play these songs.
Well, here's the
and
thing.
And then we would just basically like patronize you by being like, oh yeah, like, all right, that sounds good, and then just go back and do exactly what we wanted to do.
No, you're right. Okay, so Mike, I want to get your take on this too, because I don't want to be the alpha asshole of the band. That's the last thing I want to be.
Well, and I don't want to shit all over the old band.
No,
but some
no.
groups of guys, they need more direction. And I actually benefit from being told, hey, how about if you play this? And maybe I'll disagree with it, but I like suggestions, because sometimes I'm just lost and I'm just doubling what someone else is playing. I'm like looking for something. I'm noodling around. Oh, that didn't work. That didn't work. And they, so if you have something for me to play, I want to know about it. So that, you know, I don't want no notes. But I much earlier, like when I joined, there would be a lot more of you, you know, trying to control the rhythm section, trying to control the tempo. And now, you know, I feel like maybe you don't need to. You get a bunch of guys together that kind of get it. The song, you know, we've heard the song, we know the song, and we know what it needs. We don't need you to tell us.
Yeah,
it definitely took us getting your trust, and
I think that was it. If anything, and that's maybe not fair. I think because the band started technically, February 2010, and it was me and Kenton and Chris. And Chris was in the band as drummer until Ben took over September 2012, so over 2 years. And I played with him before. And Kenton was, you know, and still is one of my great friends. And he just texted me one day. He's like, hey, my dad's got a bass and a bass amp. You want to jam? Hadn't done it for a couple of years. I said, sure, let's do it. So I think that maybe, and this wasn't fair on my part, in the formative stages of where we are now, which is the band proper, is how I'll call it, because it's the first time where everybody's bouncing ideas off one another. And even if I bring in something skeletal, there are occasions still where I have in my mind, oh, this is how it should sound, whatever. But I think that idea that you just mentioned there, Alan, that this idea of trust, I knew how good everything, like, I knew how good individually everybody was. It was like, damn, like, we got potential. I think if anything, it was just an idea of, I want to make sure that we all learn all the old stuff, get it down.
And I definitely didn't do myself any favors, because I pretty much learned our songs through trial and error of playing shows and having you look over your shoulder like, what are you playing?
The death stare. I don't give those as much. Do I? I hope
no,
not.
No. The last one I got was when I was on like an hour and a half of sleep when we played the marathon.
And oh,
I
just, oh yeah.
And we bunged up that
rock and roll.
Yeah. That was not anybody's fault but my own. Yeah. And that was like, there was this wall of sound coming back. I couldn't hear anything that was going on. So I just missed the change altogether. And there was just, everyone's looking like, I think Mike's on the side like, yeah, this is going pretty well. And then you look over at me and you're like, get it together. And like, you had all the right in the world, because I was not playing anything like
it. It was hard to hear up there, though.
Yeah, but it was really just the fact that it was that first song. Like,
sure, it was early.
I was getting used to it. And rock and roll has, I still have this inherent fear every time we play it. Like,
I still watch for the changes.
No, yeah. It's one of those weird things where basically, what, they double up. It's the same progression, but they like double up the length of each chord.
Yeah.
So you go from what would have been a 12 bar to a 24 bar, or maybe an 8 bar to a 16. I forget. But
what I do now, I tune out what everyone's doing, and I just basically hit play on the Zeppelin version in my head. And just try,
I think that's
and try
the best way to do it. Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Because, I mean, the drums are going to remain consistent. And then, you know, for me and Mike, we can hear each other and be like, okay, it's A. Oh, it's D. I mean, it's going to be one of three options, right? A, D, or E. So we got that going for us.
And then there were a couple other changes that we had. One that I still look for it in Scallywag, and it makes sense.
It's during Mike's solo, and we switched to the A.
And you switched to the A, but you switched the A, like, not after two times. It's on, like, the fourth time through. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's very...
Well, no, it basically resets. So you reset, and when the solo starts, you're resetting a verse. But the thing is, before that verse starts, you had already been playing that E progression, like, twice.
Yeah.
So effectively, you go, and you aren't playing it four times, you're playing it six times.
Yeah.
And the rest of the song doesn't always have that sort of thing going on with it. I find this fascinating, though, like the band dynamic, because, you know,
Well, the reason that I love the band is because there is a dynamic. Like, there isn't a power struggle. Like, there might be one little snipe back and forth every five shows between someone.
If that.
I can remember one time, like, looking back at Ben, and I was about to snipe at him, and he just had this look on his face like, I'm so sorry.
Let's talk about Ben real quick. He'll join some podcasts later, yeah. I'm sure. And it's going to be great to get his take because he knows his shit, obviously. And the great thing is when you play with him, you kind of see all the influences. And I think this goes for all of us, that basically we're musical sponges. We basically absorb everything we've listened to, and what comes out are a mix of our influences. And also, I think that we pick and choose what we think would sound best depending on the song, and also just kind of knowing what our musical vibe is. But let's talk about Ben, and I just want to get each of your guys' takes on this. The feeling you get when you know that your drummer is literally capable of anything. And there has never been anyone I've ever played with that I have waxed their balls as a musician quite like Ben, deservedly so. Because he is a guy that he's a Mitch Mitchell kind of drummer.
Yeah.
But that's good.
I don't know what that means.
Mitch Mitchell was Jimi Hendrix's experience.
Okay.
And
he played whatever he wanted whenever he wanted.
Yes. And it was manic, and yet it worked. And it's a complete departure from Chris, the first drummer, which is very kind of Phil Rudd-like, which is fine. I mean, I love Phil Rudd. But, you know, Ben might miss a Phil every now and then. But I would rather that he takes those chances because, holy crap, when he lands one, when he lands most of them, I should say, yeah. That is pretty cool stuff. And it's fun to be on stage and look back, and the looks we give each other like, what? Like, what was that?
Yeah, we used to look at each other like, what have you done? Now we're always looking at Ben like, oh yeah, man. And I just realized this, and maybe I was thinking it all along, but I never thought about it. Playing with Ben is like riding a high-powered motorcycle. Like, it's a little scarier because it can do more than you're ready for. But when you hit it right, you know, you come out of a turn just right, or you hit the throttle too hard and it wheelies a little bit, and you're like, whoa, like, it does more than you needed, more than you expected, but it's so much more fun because of that danger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are shows we play where you can tell he has the governor on, and like he's like, just, and you'll see him just like talking to himself before the show.
Don't go nuts. Yeah. Just play the song.
Just play the damn song. Don't go crazy.
It's funny because there's a couple times that we've done, let's see, we did Hey Now a few shows back, a Cowboy Monkey, and that is our most straightforward song. We have a few, but I don't know if we have a more straightforward song than Hey Now. It's like, here's a riff. It repeats. And then we have a G to F to E, and that's really the only variation of that whole song. And he just kind of started doing this thing.
He starts playing in off-time signatures. Yeah. And just like, what? You can't keep up with me? It's like, no!
It's like, man, this all the syncopation. I can't handle it. No, it's fun to play with Ben. And again, I mentioned the Mitch Mitchell thing. I think, for me, that's the most apt comparison. And when I used to drum, there was a good friend of mine. His dad, his name's David Wilson. He's in a local blues band called The Painkillers. And I sat in for them for a couple shows. And when I would get done, they were the blues band that just wanted that, you know, shuffle. But of course, I'd be like, all right, I'm going to do more. I did too much sometimes. And he would shoot me the look, and I'd be like, gotcha. I'll reel it back a little bit. But he came and he was like, man, you're just like Mitch Mitchell. I was like, oh, thanks. And I was like, I kind of got that. Like, I mean, John Bonham was the end-all, be-all for me, and I felt like I could play most of what John Bonham could, not the really good stuff. But, you know, I could lay down a John Bonham beat.
Yeah.
But when it came down to when I was going to show off or try to add some flavor to a song, it came off as Mitch Mitchell. My groove was John Bonham, but my fills were Mitch Mitchell-esque. But then I listened to Ben, I'm like, oh, no. That is Mitch Mitchell right there.
There will be times where, Ben does it on like two or three songs when we play them live, where he'll just start doing these little hi-hat tricks, and he'll start hitting the snare whenever he wants. Like,
Yeah.
They're off, but they're not off. They're exactly what he's trying to do.
Are you talking ghost notes or like just like actual snare hits?
Like actual snare hits.
Just and not two or four.
Yeah.
What song in a particular?
He does it in
a lot of our songs have a moment before a guitar solo where it's like you can see the three lights coming down and you know the race car is about to go off. Yeah. And those lights, that's where Ben does something really kind of different to sort of unseat you, which is actually, it can be unnerving as a guitar player because you're like, oh, wait, I have to follow this weird thing. But he'll, you know, when the light turns green, he's right there on the downbeat.
So it builds up momentum, doesn't it?
It does.
It Kiss Off on the album is one.
Yeah.
The Phil going into the guitar solo on Kiss Off, I just listen, because I was, every now and then I'm trying to refresh my own memory, because the last show we played, I guess, would have been earlier this month, about 3 weeks ago. We don't have anything scheduled for the rest of this year. We're, by the way, for those that care, we get a big 2015 ahead of us. We're starting the year pretty strong. I'll let people know that, though. You'll find out soon how strong we're starting it. And that was it. I was listening to Kiss Off just to remind myself, like, the freaking words in that song. And that was it. The fill is just holy crap. And then there's also a fill at the end of the guitar solo in that, going back into the final, I guess, well, is there a chorus? No, well, there's a chorus, but it's basically just a continuation of the guitar solo. Mm-hmm. And that fill, there's a couple, like, it's not necessarily perfect, but it's still so ballsy where it's like, you know what? I forgive you for that 1/32nd note that didn't quite make it or whatever.
The one song that I was thinking about was $50 Bill. And I know that that's a little bit different because that's one of those, it's obviously in a different, it's in an off-time signature. And what he does is just so confusing to someone who's operated in nothing but like straightforward metal, speed metal, and things that I grew up playing. And just trying to follow him. There will be times where like I just hit a note and just let it ring and wait for a time. Like I'm just waiting for me to be able to dive in.
Wait
like,
for
I can play there.
Yeah. To wait for the rejoin. Yeah. Yeah.
But other than that, like, I absolutely love playing with Ben when he has the only other song that will catch me sometimes, and we don't play it too often, is Bitter Pill. And I remember when we played that one time, I looked back after the show and I was like, you know, maybe you should lay off a little bit in that. Like, I can't follow you and you're making me feel bad. And he's like, but that's what the song is. It's my song.
Hey, you know, and that's that. I'm trying to think of the ones that he really features prominently on. It's obviously
$50
Bill.
That one he goes nuts on, $50 Bill.
Well, think about Bitter Pill doesn't have a guitar solo. It has a guitar break that has a sort of Thin Lizzy, you know, harmonic on the third sort of thing going on. It's cool. And what that leads into was a one-note guitar solo. And I knew that we could pull that off when we were playing it, and then Ben started taking those eight bars and was building up on the drums. And I love that idea. This idea that usually it's the guitar solo itself building it up. And I think, Mike, you would agree with me that, you know, neither of us are going to bust out a guitar solo that's going to melt your face in the traditional sense of the word, like an Eddie Van Halen or something like that. Even though there are moments, and this is why, you know, for me, the solos I have are structured. Because otherwise, I would literally just be doing guitar masturbation on the pentatonic scale, which is boring.
Which is what I do.
But here's the thing. Mike, you add these rhythmic elements, and every now, like almost not chords, but a fifth with that, you know, root note on the top or something like that. Just these subtle kind of rhythmic things, like in the Hey Now solo. That is one of my favorite moments on the record, because that's, again, not necessarily a brilliant song by any stretch. It is what it is. It's kind of throwaway, but that right there makes it. So with Bitter Pill, it was like, wait a second. What if we have everything kind of building underneath it? And the one constant is the lead guitar in that song, you know, a one note guitar solo while you two, Alan and Mike, are just, you know, is that, are you guys still playing that on the?
Yeah, I do, and he starts doing the descending.
That's thing. Right. You're doing the E to the D to the C to the D. Yeah, just repeating.
Luckily, we wrote that song when I was listening to Black Sabbath like 6 hours a day.
The C is always a good touch after E. We do that in Love That Burns too. Because the pre, right before the chorus, it goes C, down, down, E, down, down, and then C, down, down, A. I mean, that C, for whatever reason, if you're rooted in that E, the pentatonic thing is to go D, A, E, right? That's yeah. that's your traditional hard rock sort of thing. If you're going with the kind of rock and roll thing, E, A, B. But that C, there's something dissonant enough about it where, you know, that's total Sabbath right
well,
there.
I go E, D, C, D. And just like down, down, and then back up
and
just
to
keep it, you know, reciprocating. But like that's hardly a songwriting trick. That was basically, that came about because you were playing something and I didn't know the chord change under it.
And it sounded good. We all looked at each other and it was like, huh? Yeah. All right.
And then when we tried to play, like, cause we didn't practice for like a month after that, we had some obligations going on and we spent about 30 minutes trying to figure out what I was doing. And finally, you're like, you know what? Just play what I'm playing. Let's get on with the song.
It was true. Yeah, it was like, well, these are all ideas, but I don't know. I mean, they're all about the same, so let's just...
I remember the first time I ever practiced with you guys. You guys started playing a song, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to blow these guys' minds. I'm going to play some stuff that they've never heard. And just played this, like, really ugly chord behind something that was really low and was like, yeah, they're gonna like this. And you just looked at me with a real professional look that was like, maybe not the sound we're going for.
Is that what I said? That is prickish right there.
It was really low, like,
oh, okay.
You're like, I don't think we're going for the doom metal sound.
Did I say that?
Yeah, but like, understandably so.
Okay.
It was the first time I'd ever picked up a bass. So
with me. you're doing admirably on the bass. And the funny thing is, for those that don't know, if we just switched it up, and maybe it would be fun to experiment with this, and Alan, gladly, like, I would switch. Like, you can rip lead guitar in a way that I don't think me and Mike can. I mentioned, like, the Van Halen kind of riffing, the metal kind of, you know, ripping a guitar solo. That's not something I can do. I'm not fast. Mike, you're faster than me.
Okay.
No, I mean, you are. You definitely are. And at least more accurate when you get faster. When I get faster, it's basically I'm just like, you know, as we're preparing for something in 2015, I'm trying to get some solos down for that. I'm not taking the easy way out, but I am trying to find ways to make it sound as fast as the originals. But it really isn't. And
mostly like, that was just through comparison of my playing growing up. Because I would hear my brother play. Like, my brother was born to play lead guitar. I remember going to a family function when he was in, like, the 8th grade. And I was probably a little, like, 4th grade, 5th grade, Alan. And he had just gotten this thing called Pandora's Box. It was a little cord thing where you would plug in and it would model your tone to sound like something. And he started playing, I think it was Eruption on like Christmas Day. And my whole family's sitting there, or, you know, the people in my family, I love them, but they're sitting there like, ah, that box is playing for you. It's like, he's like, no. Yeah, that's not how these things work.
No, wow. Screw this family.
That was the attitude at the time, but like, now they're all coming out to his shows, and like, I would compare my playing against his my entire life, and I'm 30-40% the guitar player he is. He's just unreal, and like, I consider myself sloppy and pretty awful, and just like,
I mean, from what I've heard and seen, I don't, Mike.
Well, at that your critique of yourself is almost your compliment of me. You've told me that I don't remember exactly how you put it, but the best guitar player at making noise or something like that.
And like, I swear, I mean,
you fill a lot of space.
Oh no, and I know
guitar.
What you mean, and I appreciate it because it's what I'm going for. I know I'm not Eddie Van Halen. I'm never going to be because I'm not interested at sitting at home and drilling my scales. I didn't grow up playing the guitar. I started pretty recently.
And like, when you would hit there, you'll do these little like very punky sounds behind things, and
you'll
just have these awesome lines behind stuff that are things that I would have never come up with. I probably would have been like, all right, this is where like I do a sweep and it sounds cool, and just ruin the song.
The first indication of that was when Mike, you would just join the band and immediately you and yourself. I mean, it was a skeleton of what it had been. It's a song that's been around since 2007 when I was working with another. It was a great guitarist in town. His name is Jared Kimball, really great dude. And he brought that song over. And he really had the initial chords and everything like that. I mean, like on the first album, it's a Carpenter Kimball composition. But I kept it because I just love that damn song too much. I couldn't let it go. And, Mike came in and, for a long stretch, I mean, it was a three-piece band. We had a couple lead guitarists that basically, I think the most shows that any of these first three lead guitarists played was two. And the first guy's name was Joe. Joe Kopek. Dude could rip. We played Stranglehold, our first ever show. Basically, our first ever show was me, Kenton, and Chris. We were the backing band for this badass lead guitarist. And I was still in that phase like, are you guys ready to rock?
And at the Iron Post. And you're still in that phase.
I mean, you've been keeping your shirt on.
People are starting to ask why you keep your shirt on so much.
Was that a thing? Yeah.
Of course that was a thing.
Well, yeah. I have not taken my shirt off in a long time.
That was the running joke. Was like 11 of our first 13 shows. Yeah. It was just like, oh, yeah, it's starting to get cold out here. Might as well bust the shirt off.
It's 25 degrees outside. Guess I'll take the shirt off. Makes no sense. Yeah, no. Yeah, that phase.
And you can get away with it, like. If I did, it would just elicit boos.
There would be that noise when you turn off the you did the record thing, and everyone just looks like, "What the hell?"
The angriest. There were two times I can remember being really, really angry at a show we were playing. One of them was when a friend and I like her a lot. I hope she comes out to several of our shows, and I hope I see her.
Do I know this friend of yours?
Yeah.
Okay.
We don't go by names.
Okay.
But she was extremely drunk and just kept telling you to show your tits. And just as loud as possible.
Was this at White Horse?
No, this was... I think this might have been at Cowboy Monkey, but I have to hold the microphone away because I'm gonna upset anyone listening, but it was just like,
show us your tits!
while we're trying to play, and her voice just this megaphone of a voice coming with no amplification is cutting through our amps.
Yeah.
And finally, I looked down and I shot her a look like, shut the fuck up.
I haven't done that fortunately in a while. So, yeah, no, we went through a stream of lead guitarists, and then probably for about a year and a half, it was just a three-piece. And I had a change of bass after Kenton moved up to Chicago, and then I think it was late 2011 where it was actually Chris, the original drummer. We had a show at Bentley's, and Mike was there, and Mike was sleeping at the bar. And people were like, is he okay? were you drunk or just tired or both?
I was just that might have been back when I was still working mornings at the gas station. I don't really remember. But yeah, I wasn't wasted or anything. I was just not. If you guys hadn't asked me to come out and see the show, I wouldn't have been out. So I'm out there. I'm like, hey, I'm going to check out this show. I'm at the bar.
Yeah, I remember that. I was like, oh my God, Mike's wasted. But no, you were just tired.
Yeah.
And no one would believe that. I'm sure they were like, oh, gee. I'm like, no, he's actually tired. And Chris, our drummer, went up to Mike and said, dude, come jam with us. Because we had seen Mike playing in a band called Stonefaced. And he was the guitarist and then sang too. And it was like, whoa, the possibilities. A guy that can play both rhythm
double
and lead guitar. Right. And can sing. And, the first we had a show at Canopy Club where it was us and Stoneface, and Stoneface played a set, and then we played a set, and about halfway through, Mike joined us for six or seven songs that we had kind of worked on. And then the first full gig was at the very end of 2011. It was, the day before New Year's Eve. I was sick that night. I had a fever and a half. I felt like crap, but we persevered. And that was Mike's first full show.
And seeing him drunk at the bar probably endeared him to you for what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
I want a guy who might die.
Yeah. We want everyone in this band. Well, no, that's morbid. I was about to say everyone in this band might die at any given moment.
Everyone in this band will die one day.
That's true. That sets us apart from other bands, I think. We all might die. We all will die someday. So let's try to think of a... Yeah, I already said this earlier in this podcast. I'm awful at transitions. We've talked about ourselves quite a bit here. I want to bring up one thing before we wrap it up. I've been on a Smashing Pumpkins kick. Most notably Siamese Dream, which is, I think, generally regarded as one of the best rock albums of the 90s, yeah. I would think, right? Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness came after. That was the double album, bunch of hits on that. That was them at their peak of popularity and definitely ambition. But when you look at Siamese Dream, what it reminds me of is, you know, Bruce Springsteen had Born to Run. They call that an intentional masterpiece. And it sounds like it. It sounds like Bruce Springsteen literally said, I'm putting every damn bit of songwriting effort and all the tricks I know into this album. I'm leaving nothing to chance. I'm putting everything I know. And that's what it sounds like with Siamese Dream. That Billy Corgan put everything into that album.
Well, that's when he first started to take the reins away from everybody else.
Yeah, he recorded, that is all Billy Corgan on all bass and guitar parts on that album.
And lyrics, and that was basically the Billy Corgan, Jimmy Chamberlain project.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you had the other people in there, just, and obviously that created animosity in the band. The fact that they weren't being given the same access to stardom that he was giving himself. And I was thinking about it, what he did with that band, he's not unlike Axl Rose. Like, he had these grandiose visions of what he was going to do with the band, and then he ended up kicking out the people he didn't think were necessary.
And then he kicks out Jimmy Chamberlain. Well, don't ever do that. Don't kick out Jimmy Chamberlain.
Jimmy Chamberlain had some severe
drug problems. That's true.
And that's when you get to, like, the, what is it? Is it Adore? The song is Ava Adore.
Yeah.
And the album is Adore.
Mm-hmm. Was Jimmy Chamberlain not on that album?
I think that was his last album.
Okay. And then they've had, oh God, what have they had since then?
But I feel like that album was released 10 years too early. Because if you listen to it now, those aren't weird sounds.
No, like, not at all.
That's absolutely an album that could be released today, and it would be a lot more popular. But back then, that was in like the post-grunge era. Like, that's that weird second wave of grunge, where there was like Candlebox and Collective Soul.
Is Siamese Dream your guys' favorite? I mean, because let's be honest, for most people, and I'm not going to pretend to be a diehard Smashing Pumpkins fan, but I think for most, you know, rock fans, that the two go-to albums are Siamese Dream and then Melancholy and Infinite Sadness, which has amazing highs, but like any double album, it's kind of a sprawling mess, which is great. I mean, most of them are. But Siamese Dream, listening to that, the whole thing from top to bottom, Share of Rock is just a fantastic opener.
Yeah.
And think how simple that song is, but it's kind of the Smashing Pumpkins in a nutshell, because while it's a simple rock song at its core, the drumming is spectacular. And then the guitar solo is just what? Like, I mean, Billy Corgan, if we want to talk about lead guitar players and the solos that they put on record, I love Billy Corgan's solos.
Well,
are nuts.
He came up in the same scene that is what I grew up listening to. Like, I don't see myself as a very different guitarist from Billy Corgan, because if you ever look at him when, like, Smashing Pumpkins came to be because he went to Florida and started a metal band, and it failed. And he came back to Chicago and created Smashing Pumpkins. And then, as they say, the rest is history. But you look at pictures of him back in the 80s, and he is your standard metal guitarist.
Yeah.
He has the long blonde hair.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, it was probably bleached at the time. But, like, he just looks like, he looks like your average hair metal guy. And then he just came in and had these weird ideas, got hit by grunge the same as everyone else. You saw this with a lot of bands. A lot of the popular grunge bands were reformed hair metal bands.
Yeah.
Alice in Chains, the saddest band that has ever been, started as a hair metal band.
They're almost like humorously sad.
I love Alice in Chains. It's probably amusingly my favorite sad. Band from that era. But like, if you ever listen to the first, I think it's the first three Pantera albums, they have a song called Ride My Rocket. Like,
sounds like a song title I would make.
That sounds like it's Spinal Tap.
It is. It's just
Lick My Love Pump. It's in D minor, the saddest of keys.
Hair metal, speed metal, and they're not bad songs.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until that whole grunge thing hit.
Dude, Rivers Cuomo was in a freaking heavy metal band before Weezer.
Yeah,
but if you listen to Weezer, same thing. It's basically very simple rock, but yet the guitar solos. I mean, Weezer's guitar solos. Especially on that Blue album. I mean, those are metal guitar solos.
And
melodic. And I guess, like, there's certain ones, like, you know, Say It Ain't So, that are a little bit more restrained. But a lot of those melodic ideas come from 80s metal.
Yeah. And the cool thing about those guys is they refuse to get rid of the guitar solo. One of my favorite quotes in music, and it's from a pretty sad and hard to watch movie, which is Metallica's Some Kind of Monster.
Oh, that's a pathetic movie. But it's a fantastic watch, but I think
they're all in a terrible place.
They're in a terrible place, and unfortunately, because of the success that they'd already achieved, I think it's hard as a musician that wants your band to be heard by everybody to actually sympathize with their issues.
But
it's very difficult.
There's this moment in the movie where Bob Rock, their producer, is telling them the guitar solo is dead. This is during the recording of Saint Anger. He's like, the guitar solo is dead. It's going to make it sound dated if you play it. And Kirk Hammett's sitting there like a little wounded puppy. And he's like, well, but I think if we don't play a guitar solo, it's going to date us to this era. Which is obviously correct.
Which is good foresight.
Yeah. And Bob Rock's like, no, you're not going to do it. He ends up playing, I think there's like one solo on the entire album, and it sounds so dated. It's the only
whole album sounds like shit. It sounded like shit in 2003. It sounds like shit.
Yeah. And then sure enough, they get together with Rick Rubin and they do,
Death Magnetic.
Yeah. Death Magnetic. Yeah. Never
return to form.
I never bothered to learn the name of that album.
Well, and I think for Metallica fans, that was a breath of fresh air, because really, if we can start the Black Album as the first time that Metallica fans that had been there from the beginning probably thought, oh, this is pretty polished.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it was polished, but it was still a fantastic album. And then you get into what? Load, Reload, Garage Incorporated, S&M, which is a pretty cool live album. Not going to lie. I like S&M with the
San Francisco Symphony Orchestra. Yeah.
So, talking about guitar solos, and back to this, yeah, absolutely, right? And going back to the Smashing Pumpkins and guitar solos, just on Siamese Dream alone, Soma is one of the cooler guitar solos ever. That's just this big, sprawling 7-minute ballad, and it starts at a whisper and grows and builds and builds. And when you write a song like that, where you're literally just starting with the guitar sort of thing, and then, you know, the clean guitar sound, and then gradually it builds, the bass comes in, subtle percussion. By the end, it's just a full-blown rock opus. And I think I saw that was modeled. Soma was modeled after Prince, The Beautiful Ones, which, if you think about that on Purple Rain, is, you know, baby, baby, baby. And then by the end of it, Prince is just like yelling, and there's this, yeah, he's got that awesome James Brown scream, and it's got that great guitar solo at the end, and that's what Soma is. And that right there, and then songs like Silverfuck and Geek USA, I'm telling you, if you are not a Smashing Pumpkins fan, and you want to be blown away about how hard these guys could rock, and how good they were as a band, Geek USA.
Yeah.
Holy crap. And if you want to know how good Jimmy Chamberlain is as a rock drummer, because he's a jazz drummer that plays his drums very loudly, and hence he's in a rock band and he has all the tools that any jazz drummer ever has ever had.
I get the impression that's kind of where Ben comes from too.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Why he's so good. Now, I want to derail us a little bit, because a moment ago you said we were going to wrap it up, but there's one last thought I want to end it on, because we're sort of working our way towards it, and it's guitar solos.
Yeah.
Because we play them. But you've mentioned neither you nor I has the chops to blow anyone. No one's going to listen to our solos on the album and be like, man, that shit's transcendent. Nobody's going to sit at home and learn our solos.
No.
But we play them. because the song kind of needs them.
Yeah.
The momentum of the song is like, all right, now we need to do this other thing. And it could either be like a hey thing, you know, some of that dumb crap, or it could be a guitar solo. So I want to ask you guys, because you come from Zeppelin rock and metal, where you land on guitar solos, because I used to hate them because I came from oldies and I came from punk and I came from Green Day, which deliberately made an effort not to have guitar solos. He started doing it again. And when he started, he had them. He stopped when they were big. And when they grew up, he started sort of doing them again. But I was put off on them for a long time until I started listening to some older stuff and some, frankly, some better stuff. I don't want to say Green Day is not awesome, but, you know, some a little bit more mature, a little bit more developed songs where the whole song is like an album and there's a few different parts of each song. So I want to see where you guys come in on guitar solos as a songwriting tool, because obviously we can't use them as guitar masturbation. We use them as a part of the song. So what do you guys feel about guitars? Like, do you ever think like this solo really doesn't need to be here? This is a great song. Or is like this solo is so important to this song. You mentioned Billy Corgan solos, and his are great because they're weird.
They're very weird, very dissonant.
I guess, you know, growing up listening to what I did, guitar solos were always there. And, you know, I loved Metallica, but I think that if you take their songs, probably like 50% of the solos sound the exact same. And then there are a couple that sound really good. And then you have Slash, who was my favorite guitarist growing up. And you could see what he was doing with the solos, which was there's a different solo for a different song. And I know that sounds redundant, but if you were to have like the solo he plays in Sweet Child of Mine makes that song. It's a ballad, but that's what makes that song transcendent.
Well, three solos that each build up in intensity as you go along.
And then he has that little bridge where he just shreds the hell out of it goes into it. And then there's the Paradise City solo, which is just him having a party on his guitar.
You're right. Yeah.
And like, then you get to maybe something like Welcome to the Jungle, which is just kind of like a rocking solo. Obviously it was planned out, but it's not grandiose. It's not just playing notes for the hell of it, but it fits the song. And I think that was something that era had that a lot of, I don't know, what mainly I want to get back to is the fact that like you listen to Deep Purple, and it's been widely documented that every single solo that he played was just off the cuff. He improvised every single one of them except for one. And that solo is my personal favorite he did, which is Highway Star.
That song, if you have ever been on the fence about Deep Purple, just play that song really loud.
Yeah.
That is incredible musicianship. And when you really pay attention to all the parts that are in that song and what the rhythm section is doing, it's exhausting. There is so much precision in that song. And the guitar solo, especially, like, are you talking about...
He coordinated all of that before.
Oh, God.
And
it's cool.
He has other solos that are as good. Like,
yeah.
Child in Time is awesome. Burn is an awesome song. But that organized, orchestrated guitar solo is really where you get a lot of stuff.
For me, the guitar solo, that's a really good question, Mike, because I think that, for me, I look at when I was younger, and obviously Zeppelin was one of the formative things. I mean, I say that ad nauseum, I know, but, you know, of course, Stairway, yeah, that's the first big one. I gotta say, Alan, you've kind of shifted my view of guitar solos a bit. You just told me one time, kind of fleeting, you said, you know, The Rover by Zeppelin, that's one of my favorite guitar solos. And that was always there. I knew that guitar solo by heart, but I'd never really given it the credence that it probably deserved. And ever since then, The Rover has crept its way, I don't know about top 10 Zeppelin songs, but pretty close.
It's such a perfectly done solo.
It's a great, and that's just it. From a songwriting perspective, it's perfect. It's a grungier sound, and it doesn't sound like any other Zeppelin song, It's a lot more chordal as far as the songwriting itself goes, but the guitar solo is just perfect. And that right there, I could play the Rover guitar solo. And I think that's why I relate to it. I hear it. I'm like, you know what? If I were to sit down and learn this thing, I could play it perfectly. You know, it would take a little bit of time because Jimmy Page is still, you know, Jimmy Page, and I'm not Jimmy Page. So yeah, early on, it's something like Stairway to Heaven, and now it's like the Rover. So as far as serving the song, I don't know if I could give you a quick ranking of, you know, the guitar solos that have really stood out to me. I mean, there's obviously the guys that can just shred like Eddie Van Halen. Romeo Delight is one of my favorite guitar solos, because sometimes I think the best part of a guitar solo is it built, usually you built at the guitar solo, but can the guitar solo itself build to something else? And I think that's what in Romeo Delight, for instance, the way that it ends and it gets down to this sort of rhythmic thing that is just excellent. And then I look at some of our songs, and my favorite guitar solos in our songs build up to whether it be a big final chorus or something like that. That's really what it is. It's a bridge between, it's what separates the sort of regular rock band from the punk rock band. I like punk rock music. I love the ideas behind it, but I don't love it.
Well, I think
there's less drama musically. They give you a song and that's it. It's a statement. But the rock songs, especially ones with the solos, especially with the building, everything is it's theater. It's got emotion because it builds, like you were saying.
I think probably the best solo you've done so far was the one you recorded on Love That Burns. Like you,
and that's the thing. My stuff is so pre-done. I mean, that one was completely planned. On Your Own Again is one that I'm proud of, just because I was really listening to Queens, and it's not, I'm not going to say that that's like a Josh Homme solo, but there's certain little, you know, no, it's everything I used to do was so pentatonic. That's bass pentatonic, but there are just a few other things in there that, you know, okay, this is maybe something Josh Homme would do. That's what I was going for that. But Love That Burns is like, okay, what's the biggest guitar solo I can think of and play successfully?
And
that's the key, right? Like, what can you actually play and not screw up?
Well, and I know this is just the most masturbatory way to handle.
We've been masturbating recording our band for a while here, like, on this podcast, so it's okay.
Whenever we record something, I listen to it ad nauseum in my car. And I remember just having my volume up real loud at work one night, listening to your solo in Love That Burns, and just thinking, like, the note choice was there. That's a solo I would have never played, and I hated you for playing it.
Well, I remember when you first gave me the almost mixed down version of that album, and just to give you the last few notes, the only thing I had to say about that song was I wrote down, like, in all caps on my little notepad, Mega Man! Exclamation point. That solo is so melodic, it reminds me of Mega Man. Like, it doesn't sound improvised, it sounds scripted, but it's a good thing. I like the scripted solo. I mean,
I do too. Little
solo that I play in 3 Empty Bottles, the one that's always the same, I hesitate to even call it a solo, it's just a lead
line. It's more of a break.
But yeah. I love playing that, even though it's always the same.
I'm trying to think of other solos of ours that are scripted.
Well, I always do the same thing right after you say Mike Solomon on the guitar, go, the rest of it, beginning's always the same, because I played that once and I was like, oh, that's it. I nailed it. And I try to do, you know, I improvise all the solos, but if I get something, I'll keep it.
Real quick, lead guitarist solo. So I'm not talking about a particular song, but the guitarist who solos most consistently, you just like them. You, for whatever reason, you listen to that guy, you're like, oh yeah, I like most of his solos, at least at a higher clip than I do this other guitarist here.
Brian May.
Okay. Yeah.
I probably go with, they're kind of like,
you know, too many.
They're kind of like the really like girly metal band right now, but Sinister Gates from Avenged Sevenfold.
Okay.
Every solo he does is obviously like reasonably well planned, and there's some place that he's trying to take it, and like, it's just guitar porn. That's the function that music serves to me. I'm not trying to make a statement to myself or like really get a feeling out of myself. It's just guitar porn.
See, when I watch porn, it is to get a feeling out of, but okay.
I just watch it for the production value, frankly.
The lighting was great.
For me, this is what's great about Guitar Souls, and Mike, I'm glad you brought this up, because, I mean, I think sometimes guitar solos may become cliche, or people are like, oh, God, if we put a guitar solo here, is that basically, we've used the word masturbation before with it, but I think absolutely, it's this idea of, you know, musical masturbation, and don't go too far with it, but screw that. I mean,
this got real overtly sexual.
Absolutely. From porn to masturbation.
I think it's because he walked in. We have a guest today.
Yeah, we have a guest. Mark is in the house, by the way. Hello, Mark. And the great thing about guitar solos is the different flavors that you get from each guitar player. And I guess flavors is probably not the word I want to use. But we're still getting overtly sexual here. I usually on any given time am into three or four bands. In other words, on my iPod, I got however many artists, but I don't usually cycle through a bunch of them in a week. I'm on three or four max. And AC/DC was one that I've been listening to sort of in preparation of their next album, which is, it's going to leak any time, but it's coming out December 2nd. And Angus Young is, I don't want to say underrated, because AC/DC is one of the most popular bands in the world. But there's guitar solos like in Let There Be Rock and Whole Lotta Rosie and Up to My Neck in You that just build and build. And I think he's, in a weird way, we're talking AC/DC here, a band that lacks any subtlety whatsoever. But I will say that he's one of the more tasteful guitar soloists out there.
You know, it's funny. I was listening to AC/DC, and you mentioned earlier that you could play that Zeppelin solo. And I can play about 80% of any AC/DC solo, except that one bit where he's like, and you're like, oh, well, okay, you're also really good. But yeah, he plays these accessible, get-stuck-in-your-head singable solos.
Yeah, that, and then he plays them with such a ferocity that even if the note might not be the best one, he plays in a certain way, and it's got this, like, trang to it, like, you know, that just rings out. And just the sound of his guitar. And I'm telling you, like, for anyone that hasn't listened to Up to My Neck and You, and it's the mix of his solo and also to the point of guitar solos and bands actually building up something under that guitar solo. What's the rhythm guitarist and the bass player and the drummer doing under that solo? Are they also building momentum? Because I think we could all agree that some of the best solos are as you're listening to it. If you're driving, all of a sudden, before you know it, you're going 15, 20 miles over the speed limit in a residential area because that guitar solo just kicks too much ass and the band is just, you know, gaining steam behind it.
Headbanging is so hard you can't feel the bumps of the people under you.
Yeah. That's morbid. From the overtly sexual to the overtly morbid. Dead kids on the road. What were you saying?
He didn't say anything about
guitar
kids.
Solos.
Well, no. What you were saying about Angus Young, I've always found like the same one guy who really is underrated. Like, no one is going to buy that Angus Young is underrated.
No.
He's the guitarist of AC/DC. But like the guy in the Cars, to the point that I don't know his
name. Is it Rick Ocasek?
Now that's segue.
That's the singer.
And by the way, I wonder if I'm even saying there's certain musicians' names, or it could be musician, celebrity, or anything, where you see their name, you read it enough, but you're never quite sure if you're saying their name correctly.
Yeah.
Rick Ocasek, is that it?
Yeah. Okay. I believe that's all it. Right. But no, their guitarist does the same thing where he'll play something, and then if you listen to it a lot, you're like, oh, he's really good at guitar. But what's his name?
I'm trying to think of other sort of forgotten good guitar players. We were talking, we had to discuss different bands. I'm trying to think how to politically say this. We were discussing different bands that we could cover songs for a particular event. And we had one, we weren't sure if we could do it, so we came with some backups, and we thought, well, Thin Lizzy. Okay, that's cool. It's a two-guitar band. That's one right there where maybe people couldn't always name whoever the Thin Lizzy lead guitarist were. Gary Moore is usually the most recognized guy. But whether it be Thin Lizzy, whether it be freaking Justin Hawkins from The Darkness. I mean, the fact that he's the lead vocalist, but he's also doing half of the guitar solos too. I think there's plenty of guys out there that just kind of go unrecognized, but they're, again, I think if there's one characteristic of a guitar solo that I look for the most, it's tasteful, whatever that is. And the one guy that I will put over anybody that never played a misplaced note, at least in their prime, David Gilmour from Pink Floyd.
Yeah, like
he never a misplaced note.
And he was always someone who always had the governor on. Like, you know he can play, you know he can rip. Mm-hmm. He's not going to show you. He does occasionally, but like it's nothing, you know, earth shattering.
Well, I look at it like this, because David Gilmour not only just technically fantastic, but okay, the Edge for U2. No one's ever going to say, "Oh man, I love this Edge guitar solo." I love U2, but he doesn't have a lot of guitar solos, which is fine. That doesn't serve the songs most of the time, and it wouldn't make sense. However, basically, David Gilmour, it takes all the tone and all the tricks that the Edge ever had and mixes it with, I don't know, who was that? John McLaughlin, the old jazz guitarist that did like an album with Santana and a few other guys.
My Vision Orchestra.
Yeah, so I just look at what David Gilmour does. And again, back to this not a misplaced note and just the tasteful guitar solo, Time from Dark Side of the Moon. Or Money. I mean, I know Money is a, you know, the most recognizable song from that, but listen to that guitar solo. But most importantly, Time. I'm telling you, the guitar solo from Time is just so good.
There's a guitar World article, and obviously this will probably change over the last 15 years, 20 years, but it was in 1994, and it was the greatest solos ever recorded. And you could tell, like, some of the things that got put in there. No, it was 96, because like number 30 was like Paranoid Android by Radiohead.
I do love that guitar solo.
But like,
it's not top 50.
It's not top 100, but
I like it a lot.
That list probably would have had Smells Like Teen Spirit in it. Not because it's great, just because it's right.
I would have won if there was any Radiohead song. I would have went with
Come As You Are, actually, whatever. Yeah.
Smells Like Teen Spirit was in there.
Down, 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 down. Basically, just, you're just playing just the vocal.
Right. But that it belonged there.
You're right. It did. And whatever he was doing, whatever effects were on that guitar, was it a major chorus kind of pedal going on? It's got this weird
few things. There was definitely some chorus.
This warbled kind of thing.
But no, that Time was like, I think, seventh overall on that list. One was Stairway to Heaven. Two was Freebird.
No. That song. Oh,
I could play Freebird early on.
Well, here's the I Freebird.
G G G F D F G. Like it's three freaking notes.
Well,
and then
the beginning of it is, but it's a long solo. I went to see live karaoke band with a friend of mine who's just really a total music nerd. Like not so much a guitar nerd, but a music nerd. He actually plays the keyboard. But somebody yelled Freebird like you do. And they played it, but not only did they play it, but they played the solo exactly right, beginning to end. And then he played his own solo, kind of like, fuck you, Freebird guy, we're going to play a 15-minute song. And I was just like, I love you guys.
If
you're
going to
do it, give him what he asked for, make him regret it.
Real quick, you mentioned Paranoid Android. And I think a future podcast, because we referenced Radiohead in the first one, I think they're a great case study as far as just rock music goes, because some people are like, oh, God, they're a total hipster band. And yes, a bunch of hipsters like Radiohead, and I hate hipsters. Well, I'm not a hipster. Well, but you're nice, and I know you. If I got to know these other hipsters, maybe I'd like them too. I went to see Birdman at the Art Theater.
Ooh, how was it?
Oh, it was fantastic.
Awesome.
But, yeah, please go see that for anyone that hasn't. But, you know, I felt a little bit out of place because there were a lot of scarves, and the scarf per person ratio was ridiculous.
Oh,
I got a scarf too, but but when I wear it,
you don't wear four.
I don't wear four, and they aren't flannel scarves. And oh man, I need to be careful what I say here. I don't want to like alienate any potential audience.
I doubt many of our listeners are wearing fedoras as we speak.
Well,
hey, I have a fedora.
Yeah, but again, I know you and you're nice. So
if you're a hipster, come introduce yourself. Let us get to know you and we'll like you.
Last for you, because I would like to later on in future podcasts, because Radiohead, you know, they just do whatever they want. And for better or worse, they do whatever they want. But when they were a true rock band with the bends, if we're talking about guitar solos, just. And the last 30 seconds of that song are some of the fiercest rock music of the 90s. And that's saying something. You know, we were talking about Smashing Pumpkins, which led us into guitar solos. And it's got all that. Johnny Greenwood, when he wants to rip, and it's cool seeing him become a composer for movies with, I think There Will Be Blood soundtrack is one of my favorites ever. He's doing every basically Paul Thomas Anderson movie, but when he wants to rip, he can't. He hardly does.
Yeah.
It's sort of like John Mayer. He writes like, your body's an amusement park. And it's like, I could solo, but I'm not going to. So when we want to talk about the worth of a guitar solo, sometimes it's like just shut up and quit singing words and just whip on guitar. Because isn't that one of the great traditions of rock music?
Yeah, just throwing caution to the wind. Yeah, we got
it. I love you, baby. I want to bang you, baby. Okay, where's that guitar?
Yeah. Banger with the sweet sounds from your Fender Stratocaster playing out of a Marshall amp. Or whatever it may be.
Just happens to be the equipment that you have.
Well, okay. It's been fun, guys. I think what we're going to do... This thing just got overtly sexual again. I think what we're going to do, because we have over a couple hours of material, we're probably going to break this up into two with the holiday season, Thanksgiving coming up like that. You'll probably be hearing this portion of it after Thanksgiving. The good news is, whatever podcast you're listening to, we are on iTunes now.
All right.
Podcast
yeah.
is?
Yeah. Well, awesome. You got to do, you submit this whole thing, like Podomatic is our server. You submit this link to it, and then iTunes emailed us back, said you're approved. So if you have...
Well, I'm sorry. I'm going to apologize to the Apple company for that last podcast.
I think we should get sponsored, actually.
Yeah, let's get some audible.com or dollarshaveclub.com.
I'll see if Arby's is interested, actually. I would prefer Arby's to be the Declan's podcast sponsor. But whoever it would be, that'd be great, because, hey, we're on iTunes. So whether it be on your computer or your iPhone, however you get it, just go to your podcast app and search for Decadence. We're on there. And we got this. Did you guys see the cover I made for it?
Yeah.
Okay. No. Do you like that?
I did.
Okay. It's a chick in a blue...
Big surprise.
Yeah, I know, right? That's basically the whole thing. Especially the second album cover. It's like, I'm going to put a 12-year-old girl on there. But there's a 12-year-old boy.
So it's okay.
Well...
They're drinking whiskey and smoking cigarettes.
I'm surprised that we didn't get more blowback from that. I mean, granted, it's not like we've sold, it's not like we're going platinum here, but I mean, you know, Hot Press and Rolling Stone and New Musical Express didn't pick up the story.
You let me know when that lawyer calls.
Well, that's the thing is, like, I kept looking for any sort of copyright or any authorship on that photo, and it wasn't there. It was public domain. I said, well, if it's public domain, I'm taking it.
And now when you say it on tape.
then
we can.
I'm pretty
due diligence
sure.
people. We put in the time.
We put in the time. I looked and then eventually I gave up. And
we
I
made
said,
sure
you know,
our stealing was right.
Well, Zeppelin stole blues songs. At least we're just stealing a cover art, you know. I think there is something, though, that if you sell over 1,000 copies, then the authorship thing comes into question. For those that are wondering.
We're at like 14,000. You should help.
We do get these things in the mail from, the email, you know, the mail over the internet thing, from our digital distributor. We get people listening on Spotify
awesome.
Quite a bit, but
most of that's me.
As Taylor Swift has taught us, that doesn't do a lot. So we're gradually building up our wealth as a band.
Our fan base.
But that's why we're doing these podcasts, trying to grow up.
Three drunk TGI Fridays. Patrons at a time.
They loved us. Hey, and real quick, as we're closing here, that was one of the coolest anecdotes. Three different older gentlemen that are fans of ours. They were at TGI Fridays for a gig, and we're talking to them afterwards, and they say, hey, man, we listen to the first album, but most of the second album, we get in our garage, man, and we just hang out there and jam your shit out. And I cannot tell you how much of a thrill that was.
The best part is we were playing a cover. And one of the guys in the audience yelled, play more original shit! And I was like, oh my God.
that isn't that a good feeling right there?
It's the sure. best.
Yeah. Well, hey guys, for Alan Beebe.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Can you give a hoi hoi?
Hoi hoi.
And thank you. And Mike Solomon.
Hey, everybody.
At the start of the podcast, you were like, hey.
That's how, oh, I'm sexy.
That's Mike's introduction to the podcast.
3 hours ago.
Yeah. I'm Mike Carpenter. It's been fun. We're going to, again, be publishing these on a weekly basis. And if you need to, we'll be posting them on our Facebook page, on our website, and you can always find them on iTunes, on your podcast app, on your iPhone as well. So, for Alan Beebe, Mike Solomon, I'm Mike Carpenter. Good at morning. Oh, shit. I got to do it again.
It's the fucking Truman Show. Forget that.
No. You can have a sign off. I have a sign on, which is good morning, good afternoon, good evening.
We're two podcasts in. We'll get the sign off, but I don't think this is it.
Oh, well, just give me a chance.
All right, go for it.
So I open with, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever you may be listening. I'm at the blah, blah, blah. So, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.